Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here with a little of this, a little of that. Today's trope program is truly a little of this and a little of that. And let me read you what we're going to be talking about. First of all, Hollywood's secret weapon. And then the future of the oceans. Migration via Mexico. And should there be time, we'll look at the current status of ISIS and maybe end up with how to speak Brit if you go to England. Let's look at our first item here, Hollywood's secret weapon. A new documentary entitled Bombshell, The Hedy Lamarr Story, unearths the movie star's World War II invention, an ingenious forerunner of high-tech communications. Just what did Hedy Lamarr invent? Well, during World War II, she invented a secret communication system for the Allies. It was a secure radio signal that would allow Allied ships to control their torpedoes. The radio signal going from the ship to the torpedo would change frequencies according to a complicated code so that the Germans couldn't jam the signal. It inspired a secure digital communication system that we use today. Well, how did she become interested in this problem? As an Austrian Jew, she was very concerned about what was happening to her family she had left behind in Vienna. She wanted to bring her mother safely to the U.S., but Nazi submarines had blown up refugee ships attempting an Atlantic crossing. As it happened, Hedy had been married to a weapons manufacturer who worked with the Nazis before she escaped Austria. So she knew the kind of torpedoes the Nazis had, and she wanted to design one that would give the Allies the upper hand. Well, Lamarr and her co-inventor, musician George Antheil, were turned down by the Navy. I think the Navy was probably saying, look, it's a movie star and a concert pianist, and they don't know what they're talking about. Nevertheless, her patent was handed to a contractor in the 1950s, who at that time was building a sonobuoy, that is, a floating submarine detection device for the U.S. Navy. He put an updated version of her invention into his designs, and from there, her concept evolved into the frequency-hopping system that we use today with Wi-Fi, with Bluetooth, and with GPS. Well, how important was it for her to be recognized as an inventor? Actually, Hedy was far more proud of her invention than she was of her film career, because she thought that her films didn't amount to all that much. A UN conference this summer sees that The ocean's future is both grim and bright. Overfishing can be solved, but warming seas are a tough issue. Depending upon whom you talk to and which threat you're discussing, the challenges facing the Earth's oceans are either the most daunting or the most solvable environmental issues. Overfishing and depleted fish stocks? The answers are relatively clear, and in many places, nations are already headed in the right direction. Marine pollution and plastics? Trickier, and humanity is further from a solution. Warming seas and increased acidification? Daunting, complex, impossible to solve without addressing climate change itself. Earlier this year, the United Nations hosted the first ocean conference, addressing these and other challenges. Some 5,000 people, including the heads of state and other top officials from 193 countries, met in New York to share ideas, to make voluntary commitments, and to issue a call for action. Every second breath you take comes from ocean-produced oxygen. Without a healthy ocean, we are in deep trouble. Whether it's food, whether it's our climate, we have to have integrity for the ocean, the source of life. Among the success stories, a comeback for U.S. fisheries. Scientists say populations rebound on a short time scale when given a chance to recover. We can fix overfishing, and we can even beat some big polluters, but we have not yet come up with an independent solution to the damage that is being done to the oceans from climate change. If you want to read more about this, look at the Christian Science Monitor for June 19th this summer. Now we're looking at the face of migration via Mexico. It's nothing new for individuals to migrate from Central America and Mexico to the United States without legal documentation. But in recent years, the context around these journeys north has changed dramatically. Net migration of Mexicans has been falling for the past 15 years. And in 2015, it hit the lowest levels in more than five decades. That's partly due to slower population growth and an improved Mexican economy. However, hundreds of thousands of unauthorized migrant immigrants and asylum seekers still try to make their way to the U.S. southern border in search of safety or opportunity every year. Migrants and refugees from Central America, primarily Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, account for most non-Mexicans arrested at the border. Some subgroups have emerged since 2014, including women and children, traveling alone, as well as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender migrants who are fleeing persecution at home. Migrants are traveling much farther afield as well, from Haiti, from Cuba, and parts of Africa and Asia. Despite all of the attention on the U.S.-Mexican border, the gateway to the U.S. could be considered more than 1,000 miles south, where Mexico meets Guatemala. That was the realization, at least, in 2014, when tens of thousands of unaccompanied minors from across Central America were arriving in the U.S. via Mexico. At the urging of the U.S., Mexico launched Plan Frontera Sur, a program that aims to formalize Mexico's entry and exit practices at its southern border and to decrease human rights violations there. As a result, detentions at the border jumped, and Mexico doubled the number of deportations in that area during the program's first full year. Plan Frontera Sur changed the way migrants move through Mexico, and human rights groups say it's made the journey riskier. Men, women, and children en route to the U.S. are retreating into the shadows in an effort to evade officials who migrants said were responsible for over 40% of the crimes they'd experienced during their journeys, according to a report from a migrant support network. Fewer migrants are traveling north on trains, which has often led to serious injuries or death. But along the tracks runs a network of shelters that could be used for feeding or housing migrants and to help them conduct journeys to medical and legal support. Plan Frontera Sur has also opened channels for criminal gangs to get more involved in moving migrants across the country. As the journey to the U.S. becomes riskier and the current administration pledges to crack down on immigrants residing in the U.S. without proper documentation, many migrants are halting their journeys or heading in new directions as they look for safety or opportunity. Mexico has seen a sharp uptick in asylum applications and expects the number to reach 20,000 this year. Nearby Belize and Costa Rica are also seeing more arrivals from the Northern Triangle, made up of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. According to the United Nations, 14% of migrants from these three countries move elsewhere in Central America. But leaving home doesn't always mean a lengthy journey. An estimated 700,000 people in the Northern Triangle are internally displaced. Why are people migrating to the U.S. in the first place? It depends. For many in the Northern Triangle, leaving home is a life or death decision. El Salvador and Honduras have two of the highest murder rates in the world for countries not officially at war. In a recent report by the Organization of American States, found that hunger due to prolonged drought is becoming an increasingly key reason for Central Americans to flee. But there are political reasons as well. Last year, for example, Cuban migrants were racing against the clock to arrive in the U.S. before changes in the wet foot, dry foot policy. If you want to read more about this, consult October the 9th, Christian Science Monitor. And now, the Islamic State, the year in review so far. The jihadist group is behind a recent spate of attacks during the summer, but it's also hitting setbacks. The news headlines about recent deadly attacks conducted by ISIS or inspired by it give the impression that its brand of global jihad is ever expanding and still dynamic. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan, when ISIS ramped up such high-profile attacks this summer, has demonstrated the jihadists' continued global reach, with incidents in Baghdad, in London, Tehran, Iran, and Marawi, in the Philippines, among other places. But two other datelines tell a different story of a 2-year decline in ISIS aspirations for its self-declared territorial state. ISIS fighters are clinging to their last toeholds. Mosul, Iraq's second largest city, fell this summer after a long fight. Mosul was the place where the jihadists had proclaimed an Islamic caliphate in 2014. And on June 21st, as Iraqi forces bore down on the mosque where that proclamation had been made, ISIS blew it up. Also in June, U.S.-backed Syrian Kurdish forces launched a much-anticipated and successful offensive against the caliphate's self-declared capital, Raqqa, in northern Syria, which also ultimately fell. But analysts warn that shrinking territory does not translate into defeat for ISIS, and much less victory over it. ISIS is at the same time a solid, a liquid, and a gas, and it can move between these forms as and when it needs to. The idea that ISIS is coming to the end, that this is the beginning of the end, is completely incorrect. Virtually gone are the polished ISIS propaganda videos that portrayed an Islamic paradise, replete with the justice of ceremonial beheadings and the cage burnings of infidel enemies. Those videos once energized Islamist recruits to flood into Syria and Iraq from around the world, but they've now dwindled as ISIS focuses on war and on a different future. A recent analysis found that ISIS portrayals of utopian life in mid-2015 accounted for 53% of the propaganda output, while war-related material was 39%. By February of this year, as Iraqi forces began to fight for Mosul, the western area, 80% was devoted to war, and just 14% was utopia-themed. Even as ISIS shrivels in Iraq and Syria, the chaos it thrived on and tapped into for local support, especially in Sunni regions of Iraq, is likely to continue. Analysts warn that sectarian, ethnic, and tribal differences will probably flare anew. There are really deep-seated social issues here that will continue to give longevity to groups like ISIS. ISIS propaganda about the Iraqi forces recapturing Mosul, for example, played on local fears of Shiite militias and their brutality. People were so worried, and ISIS has really exploited that and capitalized on that. It's good for ISIS when there is social instability and tension in these countries. And Iraq is a long way from being a cohesive, stable society now. If you want to look at a map that shows ISIS around the world, look at the July 3rd issue of the Christian Science Monitor, and you'll see that ISIS is in Algeria, Libya, West Africa, Chechnya, and Dagestan in the Caucasus region. It's in Egypt, it's in Gaza, it's in Yemen, Iraq and Syria, Afghanistan and Pakistan, and the Philippines. To finish up with today's show, I wanted to give you a few hints about how to speak Brit should you be going across the North Atlantic anytime soon. You will probably encounter people who speak in a language that you simply cannot understand. Let me give you the first one first. British Bulldog, a national symbol of Great Britain, resembling the famous wartime leader Sir Winston Churchill, and denoting strength, stubbornness, and tenacity. The Lollipop Man, affectionate term for the patrol person who helps children to cross the road outside school and carries a stop sign that resembles a lollipop. OAP. In Britain, that means old age pensioner. a person over 65 who believes that everything was better in the old days. Old school tie, a term used to denote membership of a group of people who went to the same exclusive school. And then you'll hear the word posh, often used by the lower social classes to describe a person with money and a privileged background. Willies, practical but unlovely waterproof rubber boots and the go-to footwear for country Brits. More How to Speak Brit in the future. Next program, if you tune in, please, I'll tell you what spoofed numbers are in the robocalling that we can't seem to get away from. Thanks. Come back again.